Welcome, guys, to episode 72 of Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing, and this week I bring to you Navy SEAL and Red Bull athlete Andy Stumpf. Now, I've heard Andy on multiple podcasts and thought I have to try and get this man on the show. He also did a Fire X talk to the firefighter profession. And one thing that really stuck out was, again, something that I have talked about a lot on the show, is the ownership of the role and setting the bar high. Andy was one of two people actually in that same week that had compared Special Forces to the fire service, something that I subscribe to, not saying that firemen will be able to do these crazy things that these special operators do, but the spectrum of what we're expected to do at the drop of a hat is very similar. So we talked about that. We talked about keeping that bar high. We talked about keeping training as close to reality as possible. We delved into his injuries and how he rehabbed and what he's doing now and the charity work that he does to try and raise money for his chosen charities. So this was a great conversation. At the end of it, I was already chomping at the bit to have a part two, which I will reconnect with him one day. Before we go any further again, please rate us on iTunes, share these episodes, get everyone in our profession listening to these amazing men and women, because they will change their lives, hands down. I get emails and texts all the time about how a particular guest has literally revolutionized the way someone thinks. So without further ado, I introduce to you Andy Stumpf. Enjoy. Welcome to Behind the Shield podcast, Andy. First things first, this is normally an icebreaker, but actually is more pertinent with us today because I totally got this wrong. So let's start from the beginning. Where are we finding you today?
You're finding me at my home here in Kalispell, Montana.
Okay, so not in Pacific Standard Time.
Well, it's a recent change. I don't blame you. I think a lot of people, or some people, still think that I live in San Diego, which I lived for over a decade. But in July of last year, 2017, July 1st, we crossed the border and we now live in the beautiful state of Montana.
Beautiful. Yeah, I knew that as well. That's a problem. Thinking back now, you'd mentioned that in your interview with Joe Rogan about the hunting there and how quiet it was. So I did know that. So that was on me. All right.
Well, so, like you said, you got forced to work for, what was it, 96 hours? So I think I'll allow for a little bit of a lapse in memory if you've been up for that long.
I will take that. We'll actually delve into that a little bit later too, because I want to find out what the SEALs did with that particular thing. Let's start at the very beginning. So where were you born?
I was born in, I would consider it a relatively small beach town, which is considered to be in Northern California, called Santa Cruz. And it's, if you look at it on a map, I don't know why they call it Northern California. It seems to be smack dab dead center, if not a little bit on the southern side. So great town to grow up in. Probably when I was growing up there, maybe 50,000 people, maybe 60,000 people. And I had family roots there. My father grew up there. His father was there before him. So we were pretty well tied in. It was a very safe environment for me to grow up.
All right. And what did your parents do?
My father, my family, but before my father even, was in the construction trade, specifically masonry. So a lot of brick and block. My father's father before him, started one of the first masonry companies in Santa Cruz. My father then took that business over, and I started working for him when I was 11 years old. Actually, before I was 11, just after the earthquake in 89, the large earthquake that rocked California, the California coast. And then my mom, she did a variety of things. She worked for the software company Seagate for a time when I was younger. She had her own business for a little bit of time while I was younger. And what she ended up doing before she died, or what she was doing as an occupation up until the point where she died, she was working with a conservancy organization. She was structuring and writing the grants for large swaths of property just to protect them and to make sure that they were able to go forward, whether they be for individuals or organizations.
Oh, really? It's protecting preserves?
Preserves, and it was more than just that. I think that was the lion's share of it. But I know she worked with both individuals and organizations. I know the organizations were involved with the preserves quite a bit. I'm not positive how the individuals tied in. That might just be land passing hands generationally. I'm not sure. Or lands passing from a family into a conservancy.
Okay. So she probably wouldn't be very happy about recent events then.
I don't know. My mom was a pretty quick cookie, and she was very fast to listen and very slow to talk. So she would probably be taking her time to figure out the nuts and bolts of it for herself and not just listen to what everybody is saying.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. So when you were young, were you an athlete back then?
I played sports, but I would not consider myself to be athletic. I played water polo and baseball, and growing up on a beach town, I think it was almost obligatory that I participated in the junior lifeguard program, which I did for many summers. And in all of those things, I was an athlete, but not very athletic, very average when it comes to sporting ability.
Okay. But did you find that that training in the lifeguards was a good preparation for SEALs later in life?
Anything in the water, developing a comfort level in the water. I mean, water polo probably was the biggest help when it came to those environments, but the combination of the two and being used to the ocean and being able to look at a swell and understand the tide, all of those things definitely substantially helped. Having said that, there's plenty of people who make it through who are from Iowa and have never seen the ocean before.
All right. So has you always wanted to be in the military?
I wanted to be an oceanographer first when I was very young. And then when I was still, I would consider to be very young, around the age of 11, I first got introduced to the idea or the concept of being a SEAL. And it definitely sunk its hooks into me. And I would say it was a gravitational force in my life from that point on. And I actually didn't even consider it being in the military. I was very focused on just that occupation, even though, of course, that occupation is in the military. I don't know why I didn't necessarily connect the two. I just wanted to be a SEAL, and the military was just a positive benefit that came with that. So it was since I was very young that I knew the direction that I wanted to go.
Brilliant. All right. And what was that road into the SEALs like? Where did you start, and what age were you?
I was 17 when I first went and spoke with a Navy recruiter, and being a minor, if you're going to enlist, you're going to need your parents' permission to do so. So I took a piece of paper home to my mom and dad and asked them to sign for me because I was legally not able to sign for myself. And I'm pretty sure that they had different hopes and dreams and aspirations for the way I would take my life, but they did not voice any of those, and instead they chose to let me pursue the path that I wanted to go down and become the person that I wanted to be. So they signed for me. Looking back on it, all I really did was help a Navy recruiter fill her billet for that month, because you cannot go into the military until you're 18. So I had to wait until I was actually 18, which was shortly after graduation from high school, and went to boot camp, which all military services have their own entry procedure. The Navy boot camp I went to was in Great Lakes near Chicago. I believe it was 8 weeks long. And in the third week of that, you take a very, very basic test of running and swimming, push-ups, pull-ups, and sit-ups. And if you meet the minimum criteria, you're then eligible for the BUDS pool. BUDS is the SEAL selection program, stands for Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL. You are not a SEAL at the end of BUDS, and the emphasis should be on the B. It's very basic. But before you go there, because the attrition rate is so high, and this is the route that I went in, it has since been changed, and they have streamlined the pipeline to get people there. I had to pick an occupational school in case I did not make it through the training, and then they would have sent me to the Fleet Navy to be a specialist in that occupation. And for me, I chose the one that had the shortest school, which was an 8-week long course in operating a radar scope. I'm still yet to ever see one. So I went to that course, graduated that course, and then went to BUDS, checked into BUDS, and from there, I mean, the story is what it is. I made it through and then continued on to my SEAL career. But the pipeline is, you have to enlist, obviously, or enlist or become commissioned, and then get your way to buds. That's the narrow end of the funnel for people who want to become a SEAL.
Right. Now, I think I want to say it was Mark Divine, but I've had several of your fellow SEALs on the show. And it's funny how one of their motivating factors in buds was purely not to be washed out and have to go to to look at radars the rest of their career or whatever the chosen field was.
If it was your, if it was the one thing that you wanted to do, it would have been very hard to tolerate the alternate. So that's a pretty common narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I love getting special forces soldiers on here, and I've got actually two Lamb is going to be this afternoon as well.
Very cool.
And I've got Tim Kennedy coming here doing a workshop actually in Ocala where I live. And the reason being, and I've heard you talk about this, I want to delve into this a little bit later in the interview, is I personally compare fire police to special forces. Now, not excuse me, not saying that we're the same percentage of the overall population, but what's required of us is such a broad spectrum of things that I personally feel the bar needs to be set high and then kept high. And I use, you know, buds and the comparable special forces entry programs to show to me what's the gold standard. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you don't meet the criteria, there is no bringing that bar down a little bit to meet the bums on seats quota. They kept that pretty solid the whole time. Is that right?
They have done an exceptional job, in my opinion, since the inception of the training program of holding the line. They always want more. You know, I'm sure they want more firefighters. They want more police officers. They definitely want more SEALs as well. And I think the goal has been to get it to either 2,000 or 2,500 active duty SEALs for probably close to a decade. And instead of focusing on that number, they focus on keeping the training quality high. And like you said, you can either meet the standards or you can pack a lunch and go somewhere else.
Yeah, and I love that. And I think that was how certainly some departments, I came from one specifically that was exactly that. And their thing was, look, it's not personal. The other departments that would love to have you, you're just not for us. And I saw the result was a very, very professional and an able group of male and female firefighters that I would walk into a fire with any one of them.
Yeah, when you start modifying the standards and you're looking only at output, I think it might look like a short-term victory because you can look and you can point to a number and say, hey, look what we've done. We've increased our throughput by, say, 20%. But that's very myopic, in my opinion, because you're looking 2 inches in front of your face. Four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10 years down the road, where an individual that squeaked through or shouldn't have made it through, that then gets pushed through, eventually you're going to get put into a position where you might have some sort of leadership or where somebody else is going to be relying upon you. And unfortunately, that's where that inadequacy is going to show itself. So you had a short-term victory for a long-term failure.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Now, what's interesting from the story I've heard and all I've heard, listened to you in multiple podcasts now, as that you entered the SEAL program during peacetime, but then transitioned during, wartime. So when you first entered and it was peacetime, what did the week look like as a SEAL?
Yes, it was, let's just say it was an interesting shift about 5 years into my career. Pre-9/11 was a very different time in the community. And I'm very appreciative of the fact that I got to experience that, because it gave me a better understanding of where the force came from, as opposed to what everybody seems to recognize the force as being now with the books and the movies and all the stuff that draws so much attention. So when I first got in 96, my first deployment was to Kadena, Japan for 6 months. We stayed on an Air Force base. We trained, though, just like we were getting ready to go to war. We had an 18-month workup and then a 6-month deployment. Came back and started the entire process again, another 18-month workup and a 6-month deployment, but this time it was to Guam. And it was awesome. I was very young, and every single day there was a different challenge. I'm sure much like a firefighter or a police or, you know, first responder, people look at you as from externally, they might think that you have just one job, but to be really good at the job, you have to be almost a master of all, a jack of all trades, a master of none, I should say. So for us, we know we have to do medical training, but we also need to know how to shoot our guns. We need to know how to talk on a radio, but also navigate through every type of environment, whether it be a riverine environment or out in the middle of the ocean or a jungle or a mountaintop. We need to be able to operate in the cold weather. So, and many, many more things. And we spend all of our time trying to gain and develop and then maintain our competency. So that your schedule is packed. And as a young man who was surrounded by people that I looked up to, it was an amazing environment. And every day it was like, what are we going to do today? Oh, we're going to jump out of airplanes today. Yes, I love my job. What are we going to do tomorrow? Oh, we're going to shoot rockets tomorrow. Awesome. I love my job even more. And then we would go deploy and we would sit overseas in a peacetime environment with not the hopes, but there in case something happened or the country called or something needed to be done. That's really what we were doing, is just waiting for the needs of the Navy or the needs of the nation to call us. And it didn't happen. So we took that opportunity to train even harder. And I think that really paid off when the world shifted. I would not say not only for the SEAL teams, but for the U.S., but for the world in general. When that happened in September of 2001, you know, we were well prepared.
Now, I want to underline what you just said, because there is a mentality, and I know it's in police and fire and EMS as well, where, and I see it a lot, you know, firsthand through my own eyes, where if it hasn't happened, it's not going to happen, which you and I know is the complete opposite. If you're a gambling person, every time you don't, you know, roll the right dice, if there's one time closer to the time that, you know, the shit does hit the fan. And, you know, I've always tried to preach this to the people around me, is if we haven't had it yet, then we have to prepare, you know, because it's definitely going to happen. But trying to get people to understand that mentality, that one day it will. So every single day that you don't train is another day that you're less and less prepared for, God forbid, when that incident occurs.
Yeah, that's an interesting, and I would agree with you, very dangerous mentality. I would say, if somebody were to verbalize that to me and say, well, it hasn't happened, so it's not going to, I would try to change their perception and say, well, if it hasn't happened, when is it going to? It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. You know, nobody thought people were going to hijack aircraft and turn them into missiles. Nobody thought somebody would come onto an airplane with explosives in their shoes or use vehicles and trucks as killing machines instead of things that can transport large portions of material, or knife attacks, or, you know, fill in the blank. It's, you're only going to be as prepared as your imagination. And we spend a lot of time trying to think like the opponent that we're going to go up against and to prepare for all of those different contingencies. A playbook is great, and I could tell you, you know, 80% of the stuff that we focus on are very traditional, what I would put in air quote, wartime skills. But the other 20% is spent thinking outside of the box and thinking about the contingencies that are going to eat your lunch.
Yeah, exactly. And then, just like you were saying with the firefighters specifically, we're responsible for so much. And this isn't a complaint. Just like you, it's amazing. We love hanging off the side of a building on a rope and then having to cut through a, you know, crashed down car and all these different responsibilities that we have. But because it's a Swiss Army knife of skills, if you're not nailing at least one of those skills every single day, you're going to fall so far behind that, again, when you're needed to, you're going to fail. And then there's lives at stake at that point.
Yeah, you get rusty very fast. I always found it to be a race against currency. You would jump for 2 weeks and be very, develop a very high level of skill. But then the next thing you know, we're underwater for the next 2 weeks. And you're, every day that you're underwater, your jumping ability is, it's decreasing very slightly. I have family in the fire service. My brother-in-law is a San Diego City firefighter who's up for captain right now. And the knowledge base and the amount of studying and practical exercises that he has to do, it was kind of shocking to me, because I even fell into that category of, oh, it's a firefighter, they just fight fires. But like you said in the description, maybe you got to get somebody out of a car. So now you need to know how to use all of those tools. You got to know how to use the truck. You got to, you know, the medical skill. I mean, all of that stuff. It's an onion with a lot of layers on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I've heard you talk as well, and this all ties into the same concept, about the importance of reality training. And that's another thing we're seeing in our profession. And before I say that, obviously, it's up to the individual crews. They can make these training opportunities harder, but you also bound by rules and regulations and people worried about getting hurt and all that kind of thing. but it's to the point where sometimes you're doing this training and it's so far from reality that it's almost pointless. So how were you guys able to walk the line with your training?
Well, I think we operated in a slightly different environment from the police, fire, and first responder community. I think most people look at those communities as life-saving organizations, for better or for worse, accurate or inaccurate. And I think the military is viewed slightly differently. I think most people view the military as a life-taking organization, which I would push back on and very heartily disagree. But that difference in perspective, when we train, we are training thinking of actively going up against an enemy that is trying to kill us. And because of the past engagements and the history from our own community, we have lessons seared into our memory from failures on the battlefield. And failures on the battlefield, and I'm sure failures on a call to a fire, you can trace them back generally, not always. I hate the term always and never. But I would say most times you can trace them back to a deficiency in training somewhere where a standard was slipped or something that was important wasn't addressed to the level that it should have been addressed. And in the SEAL teams, it generally terminates in a loss of life. And nobody wants to die. You know, you want to do your job and you want to go home, and we're doing our jobs for the benefit of others. And because the loss of life is generally the end state, it allows us to really focus our training and make the training. I mean, we aim to make the training more difficult than the realities that we're going to face in the field. Sometimes people get hurt on training exercises, and sometimes people die on our training exercises. And I think it's essential that both of those things happen. I don't think that they're good, and I don't think that the loss of life, it's catastrophic, but it shows that we're training at the level that we need to be training, because that's the level that our enemy is going to be coming at us.
Right. Yeah, I agree 100%. And obviously, we don't want anyone to die on the fire ground, but we can certainly push the envelope a bit. And, you know, it's a controlled environment as well. So we're able to make sure that injuries and the risks are kept down. But I'll give you a perfect example. I've seen training on the ladder truck where people have used belay systems. And, you know, that's all well and good, but when it comes to a fire, you're not going to have a rope round your waist. So to train like that, to me, is removing the danger of a real life rescue when it comes to a proper fire.
Yeah, I have to agree. The training you're doing should replicate the operational environment that you're going to be going into. And there's a time and place for that belay. And I would say that time and place for the belay is for somebody on their first experience with the ladder, right? Because you need to have a safety net. And the difficult training we do in the SEAL teams, that's not the training you're doing day one. It's the crawl, walk, run methodology. I mean, it's incredibly easy to overwhelm somebody and to push somebody into an environment where they could make an accident or kill themselves if they have no experience. So the belay is perfect for somebody who is just learning that skill. It's a fallback that they can rely upon, and then they can focus on the skill instead of being scared of heights. But at some point, you have to realize and take away those training wheels, in my opinion at least, so that the individual, and maybe they are scared of heights, we need to work through that, or maybe you shouldn't be a firefighter. You know, maybe you're scared of the water. Well, you should work through that, or maybe you shouldn't be a SEAL. So at some point, those safety mechanisms have to leave, and the people going through the training have to understand that they're temporary and they're there for a purpose, and they won't be there forever.
Absolutely. Okay, so when you have your SEAL team, your group, is each individual responsible for a certain specialty within that group? So you're not all required to be a high level at every skill?
There are definitely specialties. You got guys who focus on radios, guys who focus on long range navigation and shooting, guys who focus on vehicles or motors, medical, everything in between. It's the SEAL teams. It's exactly that. It's a combination of all of those different skill sets. And we always try to break our maneuver elements into comparable and similar skill sets. So in case one gets separated, there's going to be somebody who knows how to stop bleeding. Now, even though we all know, we're obviously taught basic first aid, but a higher level of care is great to have when you start leaking hydraulic fluid. So we try to make sure that somebody in each one of those maneuver elements has that ability. Obviously the ability to talk over the radio, right? So we all carry radios, but we don't all carry radios that can talk to a satellite and then bounce communications all over the world. So each element needs to have that. So there's a capability that the team has to have. And then inside of that team, it's broke up into individual skill sets. Sometimes, like a classic pairing would be a sniper and a comm guy. That job can be done by one individual. So you try to single up or double up on skill sets as much as possible, and then you just try to match the capability of the elements inside of that team.
Okay. Now, were you on the East or West Coast when you were on the teams?
I spent time on both East and West.
Okay. Did you ever work with Dr. Kurt Parsley?
Yes, I did. Dr. Kurt Parsley, who's an awesome dude. Be careful taking his sleep cocktail because it'll put you on your face. So do not take it and then drive. It's wildly effective. It's done great things for me. When I was getting ready to get out of the military, he was the one who actually helped me get to an institute on the East Coast called NICO, which is the National Intrepid Center of Excellence. And in that facility, they did a very robust workup of my medical history throughout my entire career. And that write-up was actually the mechanism that got me medically retired versus just leaving the military service with no benefit.
Oh, wow. He was,
no benefits.
He was responsible for orchestrating that?
He was. He was indeed.
Excellent. Well, I've had him on the show twice because he blew my mind the first time. He was on the Barbell Shrug, like a CrossFit style podcast, and
yep, I'm familiar with it.
Okay, brilliant. They were talking about sleep deprivation, and I'm driving to work, and I've been in fitness. I've got degrees from here and in England, and it never occurred to me the effects of sleep, especially on first responders, because you're talking about 30 years of 56 hour weeks, and the penny drops. And I had him the first time; he blew my mind. I had him the second time. I got to release it in about a week or so, but when he talked about you guys and finding these crazy, awful blood work and these symptoms and all the guys being on Ambien and then realizing that sleep was the issue, he was saying about how it reversed so many of those problems. But then I went to the firefighter community, and it's so hard to try and A, change the mentality, and B, convince people that they have to fight to get your employer to change the working conditions. So were you part of that initial wave that realized that sleep was an important element that you weren't addressing at the time?
You know, I have no idea where I would have fallen in any of that. I got introduced to him in 2012, late 2012, early 2013. And before that, I was the guy who never really thought about it. I certainly have had my issues with Ambien because it was so readily accessible, and our schedule overseas, it's difficult. We need to sleep all day long and then stay up all night long. Getting home and having to flip that on its head and seamlessly try to integrate back into family life, it's tough. And, you know, taking a couple Ambien here and there makes it easier. I didn't realize the addictive qualities of Ambien, and maybe I should say for myself, it definitely, I would start taking Ambien and then I couldn't sleep when I wasn't on it. So I was juggling overseas. Do I take the Ambien so I can sleep to be ready to do my job tomorrow? Or do I need to suffer through this, which will then cause my work performance to decrease until I can stabilize? It's tough, especially when there's a bowl of Ambien right in front of you and nobody monitoring it. It's a really tough one. And then you get really tired. And of course, right next to that bowl of Ambien in certain situations are pills that'll keep you up for 48 hours. And the only way to really sleep after that was to take more of the Ambien. It's a very destructive cycle driven by the demands of the job. Some people don't touch it at all and they can manage. I needed help on occasion to both stay awake and go to sleep. And I struggled with both, but the Ambien one really got its hooks into me because you might be passed out, but you're not, I don't think you're sleeping and your body's certainly not recovering. And when I started talking with Kirk and he gave me his recipe, his cocktail recipe, when he first gave it to me, it was all these different ingredients because I know now he has a standalone product. So I'm looking around trying to, got a grocery bag full of all these different ingredients that I was mixing together. Started taking that and actually sleeping, the difference that I felt or that I would feel when I woke up in the morning, I mean, it had impact on everything from relationships with my wife and kids to my ability at work.
Yeah. I mean, and it's funny, you take a step back, you know, of course it does. Like every mammal, when the sun goes down, goes to sleep if they're not nocturnal. But we're wondering why we're falling apart, you know, being awake every single night. So, but yeah, he blew my mind. Anyway, so I want to go back to where we left off. So we talked about pre-9/11 training and where you were deployed at that point. So what was that fateful day like for you within the SEAL teams? And then what were the, you know, the years after that like?
Well, the day itself, I would say, was extremely anticlimactic from a work perspective. I was living in an apartment in San Diego with my wife. We'd gotten married in February of that year, and the TV got turned on just in time to see the second aircraft go into the Trade Center live. And I don't think anybody really had a doubt as to what was going on at that point. And I think the natural reaction was like, all right, we need to go in and we need to pack our bags. And we're going to get on an airplane and we're going to go somewhere and we're going to do something about this. And what ended up happening was nothing, because the military is a bureaucracy. They needed time to plan. The military needed time to figure out where we were going to go, what we were going to do, how we were going to do it. And yeah, it took a little bit. So I actually didn't deploy overseas until late 2002. So it was almost a year after 9/11 before I ever set foot, and the first country that I deployed to was in Afghanistan, and so 2002 in October, so a year and a month from watching that go live to actually putting my feet on the ground.
Damn, that must have been frustrating when you've been training for so long, you're chomping at the bit.
It was frustrating, but you know, in hindsight, definitely the right call. I would rather have my guys frustrated and waiting in reserve to do something that's actually going to be impactful, as opposed to just taking the chains off the wolves and letting them run in every direction with no plan.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Now I remember you talking in one of your podcasts as well about a lot of the focus of your training pre 9/11 had been more aquatic, and now all of a sudden we're in this conflict in the middle of a desert. So did your training have to shift a lot before you even went out there?
I would say we shifted our time priorities for certain skills. As the naval special warfare option, we obviously draw our roots from the water. So we have to maintain those baseline core competency skills. I've been out of the SEAL teams now for about 5 years, but I have absolutely no doubt that the guys are at least competent in the water when it comes to diving a variety of different diving systems. They could do all of those things that the Navy might ask. What I would say is pre-9/11, we devoted more time to those legacy skill sets. And post-9/11, we devoted more time to the environment that we were going to be thrust into, or the environments that we were thrust into, and then taking the lessons learned from real time from the battlefield and integrating them into the training. So it was, like I said, a shift in priority of skill sets, but all the skill sets were still covered.
Right. Now, you mentioned earlier, and I've heard this talked about before, you talk about the workup and then the deployment. So the workup, is that all basically training for the specific mission that you're going out for?
It is, what would be the best way to describe the workup? Workup is the preseason for the NFL, to use probably a very poor analogy. You have your playbook, and then you're going to go play 15 different opponents, or however many games there are in a NFL season. So at a conventional SEAL team, meaning there's SOCOM, Special Operations Command, and then there's JSOC. JSOC, what would be the best description between the two? They are both special operations elements. JSOC commands, there are two that most people that are familiar with, are much more focused on direct action, and their intelligence generally will drive them in a much more targeted, specific location. The SOCOM level special operations forces have a much more broad template that they have to be ready for. I would say that the intelligence, once they get overseas, will drive them towards individual areas, but that's not all that they're going to do. You might go and spend your time engaging with key leaders. You might go live with the local populace for 6 or 8 months and try to build stability in villages and provinces throughout particular countries. The JSOC commands are not going to do those latter things that I talked about. So the training for the commands is a little bit different. So you just, you spend that time in that workup going over all those key skills, your shoot, move, and communicate, the baseline ones. And then the individuals will leave during that time period and sharpen their individual skills, and you bring it all back together and you get overseas and you take that playbook that you had in your preseason, and then you start playing games against an unknown opponent, an unknown enemy, and you have to be able to react. You might think the game's going to go one way, and you might think that fullback dive is going to be your go-to play, and you might get overseas and realize that that's not going to work. So you got to have more plays in the playbook.
Right. Now, excuse me. Now, how do they train that? So obviously, you know, just kind of like the police in the fire, you have your basic scenarios, but I mean, it could all go to hell in a handbasket when you actually get on there. So how do they train that kind of critical thinking in the SEAL specifically?
I mean, I think they started from day one. Special operations, I think if you break it down, a lot of people want to focus on the gear or the weapons, which look cool, you know, or the shiny assets that you get to fly around in. Those are all great, but they're only as good as the human being that's using those things. So I would actually describe special operations as nonlinear problem solving. And we expect a lot out of our people. And from day one in BUDS, you're told and you're taught that in the absence of leadership, you need to step up and you need to make a decision. That sitting there and not making a call or not thinking your way through a solution just because nobody is there to tell you to do so, it's not acceptable. Now, it's a rank-based organization. The military is, for sure. And you're used to hearing, you got to do what your boss says. But the best way to train your people to think, or one of the best ways that I have found to train your people to think, is in a training environment. And I have to emphasize this because I was having a conversation with somebody once, and he was telling me his plan moving forward was that the next, you know, fill in the blank, he was going to pull the leadership in a real world situation. I was like, whoa, dude, if you haven't practiced this, don't do it in real life. So in a training environment, I know nothing about being a firefighter, but I'm sure in your training scenarios, there are critical decision-making points that have to occur. And I would imagine that there is generally an individual or a rank or a position that is associated with making those decisions. In the SEAL teams, that's exactly the case. And so what we do is we take training environments up into those critical decision-making points, and then you pull the leader out and you watch what happens to the people that work for them. And when you first do this, it's catastrophic, which is why you do it in a training environment first. And you can actually have a training failure, which is good. Training failures need to occur. You need to allow your people to fail, stop, debrief, and talk about what it is that led to that failure and how you can prevent it in the future. So we stop and we're like, I mean, most of the time, the best and most concrete example is when we're doing drills out in the desert where you're walking along and we'll do a simulated contact drill, which is somebody shooting at you from a direction. You're supposed to shoot back and then you want to maneuver. You want to shoot and maneuver so you don't get pinned in place. Well, the calls of which direction and what's going to happen generally come from the officers or the senior personnel. And when you pull them out, the junior personnel, they're sitting there shooting their gun. And then the next thing you know, nobody's shooting and everybody's looking around at each other. Stop the training exercise and talk about what's going to happen in real life if you do that. And then give them a day. The next day we'll come back and we'll pull it out. We'll pull the leader out again. And what happens is that it gets a little bit better. It's still very chunky and there's a lot of hiccups in it. But if you repeat that process enough times, you can eventually pull as many people as you want to, because the individuals are not only thinking about their responsibility, but they're expecting somewhere in the leadership for there to be a hiccup. They're expecting there to be a deficiency, not in leadership, but in just the individual not being there. So they're proactively thinking about what they're going to do if that happens. And then when it does happen, they already have the solution. It's the difference between a proactive thinker and a reactive thinker. And we do that through every single phase of our training. And at some point, the light comes on and your people start thinking for themselves instead of sitting there like an autonomous robot waiting for somebody to tell them what to do.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that one of the challenges that we see in some of the departments is, and I hate this word because it's such a buzzword, but the micromanaging, where, you know, the person with the most bugles wants to have control of every play from every single person under, you know, beneath them, instead of empowering their leaders in the lower positions to lead their men, and then, you know, just send that up the chain of command. And just like you said, if there's a breakdown in communication, that small team is still able to do their job.
It's the only way to survive. If you work in an environment that is going to constantly be changing and information that was valid 30 seconds ago may not be valid anymore, and you're relying on rank or position, if that person who has that rank or has that position is not there with that updated information, you got a problem on your hands.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I want to talk about a very specific event in your career. You were actually wounded in combat, weren't you?
It was indeed.
Okay. So I would love to hear, because I find this fascinating, the kind of route that you took after you were wounded. So would you mind talking about, you know, what the injury was and then the road you followed in the rehab?
Yeah, the road I followed was to the hospital, not nearly as quickly as I wanted it to be. But, you know, the evening itself, or actually it was the early morning hours. It was similar to what we had done the night before, and I'm sure it would have been identical to what we were going to do the night after. So nothing spectacular there. I just ended up on the wrong side of the dice. You know, I've been to Vegas plenty of times and I've seen people on some pretty incredible rolls. And at some point in time, if you throw enough dice, you're going to hit a 7. And I think that's what happened with me. I got shot at pretty close range from a guy using an AK-47, which is a pretty big round, moving pretty quick. And it laid me flat on my back, both figuratively and metaphorically. Went from there to the hospital, from the hospital to Germany back to my house in Virginia Beach. And I got injured in 2005, early in 2005. And I would say that the medical, how would I describe this? The medical system in the Navy specifically was still trying to figure out how to deal with people coming back injured. There were not the robust mechanisms in place to support people that there were back then. And at first I used to harbor some animosity toward that. And I know that my wife did, because she kind of feels like we were left on an island. But in reality, the military has to learn, just like the SEAL teams had to learn. And they're a much bigger organization, so it takes longer. And I'm very happy that now there's many more mechanisms in place from moment of injury until many years afterward if you need that support. So that's a positive thing. I didn't necessarily have that, so I got the traditional, here's a bag, an 8-gallon Ziploc baggie full of 800 milligram Motrin. Here's your gallon Ziploc baggie of Vicodin. Here's your gallon Ziploc baggie of Percocet. Here's your gallon Ziploc baggie of Neurontin, and like 7 other pills that I didn't know necessarily what they were. And my leg felt like it was constantly on fire from the neuropathic damage. So in the daytime, I was distracted. At nighttime, it would keep me up because I would lay down and I just couldn't sleep. So I started playing around with the pills, washing them down with some questionable adult beverages that I'm sure there are warning labels all over the pill bottles saying not to do that. But it was a really difficult road for me. And at some point, I realized I had to get off of them. I was taking central nervous system suppressors to help with the neuropathic pain. And I remember one day I was driving with my wife and I was trying to do like a simple math equation. It was something to do with gasoline, like the cost of, I don't know, how much is it going to cost to fill up the tank? And I could not, for the life of me, figure out the answer. And I just knew at that moment that I needed to change course. So being on all of those meds, one of them was an anti-seizure medicine for children with a secondary or tertiary side effect of neuropathic pain control. If you stop that cold turkey, and thankfully my sister was able to educate me on a lot of this stuff because she was going through her nurse practitioner course at the time. If you stop cold turkey, as I'm sure you know, your threshold for seizures just disappears. And so even though I don't have a medical condition that would give me seizures, I'd be susceptible to having them if I just stopped. So it took me a long time to get to the dosage I was on. And it took me a long time to get off of them. But through going into a gym and literally figuring it out on my own and sweating my way through my own bullshit and through my own issues, I was able to incrementally back off of this stuff and then just threw it all away. And that took about 18 months. It's not like I woke up on a Monday and was good to go by a Friday. It was a really long process.
Now, what about mentally? I mean, you were in there, you know, in the teams amongst all your, you know, your tribe, as it were. And then all of a sudden you're ripped away from them and lying, you know, on your own with all these medications. Did you battle anything psychologically too?
I mean, it definitely makes you question your capability and your ability. You know, I had been on the right side of the odds so many times. I mean, hundreds of times I had been on the right side of the odds. And then all of a sudden you are stripped away from your job and your tribe, like you said, and the things that you're able to do. And you're left questioning yourself. And did you do something that caused it to happen? Was it a lack of ability or capability? The physical aspect, I mean, work, you know, strengthening your body again. I mean, that's easy. Just go pick up heavy shit. The mental aspect, you know, you need to do the same thing, but with your thoughts. It's very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's, I've had Sebastian Junger on the show, and he, again, has so many valid points. But, you know, we talk about leaving the military specifically, but another area, obviously, is if you get hurt, you may go back to the military. But while these men and women are lying there in a hospital bed battling these physical injuries, I mean, you know, that support structure that they had with their men and women that they had around them before is now taken away as well. So it seems to me from the outside looking in that they're very vulnerable at that point.
I would say they definitely are. And the point you bring up is very good. The support structure generally doesn't travel with them, because I got hurt overseas. I was in Germany in 24 hours. The guys I was with, they were still doing their job. And I got home probably 36 hours after that. And it was just me. You know, the people that I was with, they still had a job to do. And it was on me to figure it out. And it probably, in hindsight, yeah, it definitely, it would have been easier, you know, if I had had other people there to support me, but that wasn't the role of the people that I was with.
No. And the the initial treatment that you got as well mirrors what I got. I hurt my back lifting a patient a few years ago. Nothing, not quite as amazing story as, you know, being shot by an AK, but it was the same response. It was, okay, here's an anti-inflammatory. Here's a bunch of opiates. And no mention of rehab, of, you know, of rest, of just the basic things that the human body would need. And then, you know, talking about strengthening and getting back to work, it was all pharmaceuticals and surgery. And, you know, it was appalling. I mean, if this is the knee-jerk reaction to a soldier, a policeman, a fireman getting hurt, then it's no wonder we have the opiate addiction that we see in these careers.
Well, it's the easy button, right? It allows the... I don't want to make a character judgment against the community of the individuals that are tasked with caring, because I don't think that's it. I just think it's each individual might present with symptoms differently, and it would really probably take a lot of time to figure out exactly whether it's physical or physiological or psychological. And especially from the military, speaking from that perspective, they're not set up to do that. So the easy button is, here's your pills. You have what symptoms? This, 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 and this. Here you go. Take this and let me know how it works out. If those don't work out, we'll give you this, 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 and this. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. It's just, you know, you can cut a T-bone steak with a table saw if you want to. It's just messier.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, just getting away from the injury for a second, I have one question I forgot to ask before we delve into how you rehab physically. When you came back from a mission, and you're still out in overseas, but you're done with whatever you were tasked to do that day, was there an emphasis on rest and recovery so that you guys were, you know, operating at 100% when you went back out?
I would say there was not. You were expected to be able to operate at your highest level. What you needed to do to be able to do that was up to you. It was definitely the big boy rules. The priority was on getting the team gear squared away again, then your personal gear squared away, and then you could go take care of yourself. Some guys would go hit the gym. Other guys would go pass out. But all that was expected is the next time that the bell rang, you'd be ready to rock.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So back to the rehab. So you found CrossFit to rehab yourself. So what year was that, and what was your initial introduction?
It was in 2005. And my initial introduction was through a buddy who just said, hey, check this out. So I went to CrossFit.com. And the workout of the day, I think, was deadlift, 5 sets of 1. And I didn't know what a deadlift was. And I thought doing 1 repetition 5 times was the dumbest shit I had ever heard of in my entire life. So I immediately discarded it. And then, you know, went back to the E-stem pads that I was doing. And then the recommendation came again, probably another month or two later. I didn't know any of the movements. I didn't know anybody who knew much about the program. And, you know, fast forward a decade, I ended up working for CrossFit for 8 years. CrossFit as a methodology is, I think it's amazing. The movements, the structure, there's some pros and cons to it, and people need to go into it eyes wide open. But for the vast majority of people, if they apply the methodology correctly and don't lose their mind and forget that it's just exercise, it can do amazing things. And CrossFit's very open with the fact they didn't, you know, none of the movements that are you'll find in CrossFit were created by CrossFit. They are just a combination of things that have existed forever applied in a different structure. But I didn't know, like I had never done squats. As crazy as that is to say, I had never really done air squats. I had never done an Olympic movement. I had never focused on deadlifting. So I taught myself through just the online references and reaching out to people who knew much more than I did. But that's how I went in one the first day, and I held onto a pole and I lowered myself down as far as I could go into a squat, which was extremely partial range of motion, but that's what I could do at the time. And did some other very basic, what I'll call functional moves, sweat my ass off, and then slept really well that night. And when I woke up that next morning, I was like, okay, there's something here. And I just dove into it more, which eventually later on down the road, I ended up meeting Greg Glassman, the founder of the organization, ended up working for them, ended up teaching the Conceptual Foundation. But all through, that one night led me to all of those things.
Yeah, because the same back injury I mentioned earlier, I use CrossFit and another thing called foundation training. I don't know if you ever heard of that.
It's, I have not.
It looks like almost like yoga, but it's a chiropractor out in California as well. Healed his own back with it, but it's undoing the problems of sitting is really what it boils down to, and lengthening your muscles and strengthening them. But basically those two movement practices put together healed my back without surgery, without meds. And it's heartbreaking when you see people that go through surgery after surgery and are on meds, when you know damn well that in most cases there are movement philosophies that can do so much good and get people back, not just on their feet, but out functioning again, doing the job that they loved.
Yeah, I have to agree. And it's even worse when they're not willing to accept what some people would call an outside of the box approach to it, and they just want to stick with traditional meds, right? Because it's a doctor. The doctor knows more than I do.
Yeah, and traditional in the loose term. All right. Where were you? So after you got hurt, this is another interesting thing to me. I've been reading the history of the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Combat or Warfare, excuse me, which I guess was the precursor to the SAS in World War II. And it was funny because this all came out of the fact there was so much red tape in traditional warfare that they threw away the rule book and let this group of guys do their own thing. When you went back into the military, despite being in a special operations team, when you tried to promote, you basically faced that same red tape. So could you tell me kind of about that and how you overcame that?
Yeah, I don't know if I wouldn't call it red tape. I bounced up against the bureaucracy of the Navy.
Okay.
The advancement system on the enlistment side of the house is a combination of two things. One of them is time, minimum amount of time. And the other one is if you want to climb the ladder, the corporate ladder inside of the Navy, you have to have held key leadership positions along the way. So if you want to go from E6 to E7, which is the large jump inside of the Navy, it's where you go from a first-class petty officer to a chief petty officer. I would equate that to middle management to upper management on the enlisted side. That's not going to happen until you've met all the mandatory wickets. Probably the most important one is called the leading petty officer role. And I was doing that role on the deployment that I got shot. And when I got shot and medevaced out, when it came to the paperwork and how the Navy viewed my execution of that role, because I did not do enough time in that role, they counted it as being incomplete. So regardless of the number of times that I had submitted my package to go from E6 to E7, there was a glaring hole that they're not going to overlook. So every time I would submit, it would get denied. And that role is a 24-month role. And there was somebody else already doing it at the command that I had just transferred to. So I would have had to wait until they finished, then do it for 2 years, then submit my package. So we're talking probably realistically 4 years of being just treading water as far as the advancement system goes. So I started researching other ways to continue on in my career. And I knew that if I wanted to stay in a role that would actually have some impact. and being the military the way that it is, you know, the most junior officer coming out of the Naval Academy outranks the most senior enlisted personnel. Now, a smart junior officer would not tell the most senior personnel what to do. They would shut their mouth and they would listen. But the reality is that's how it works. And I wanted to stay in and I wanted to make a difference. So I submitted my package for a commissioning program that did not require a college degree and was accepted on the first round and switched over from being an enlisted guy to an officer for my last 5 years.
Right. Now, when you were talking about this in one of the interviews I heard, you said something very interesting to me, which was that around 10 years, you kind of hit a bit of a peak when it comes to training. And I've noticed that even as a fireman, I'm at 14 years now. And it's not that you're not learning. I mean, you're learning every day and improving. But that curve definitely starts to round off a little bit. So was that what you were seeing in your own training? Or was that what made you wanted to kind of progress up the ladder a little bit more?
I don't think it necessarily had anything to do with my desire to continue to progress on the advancement side of the house. I mean, at the 10-year mark in the SEAL teams, I would say you're well-rounded and you're at a place where you can start giving back to others. And to really effectively be able to do that, you need to do it from a leadership position because you can't have a group of chiefs sitting around and no Indians. And it takes a long time to really, making it through the entire SEAL pipeline and earning your trident, which is the actual pin you wear on your chest, that's an amazing accomplishment. But you don't know shit. And you're actually a danger probably to yourself, but more so the people around you. And at 10 years, if you've made it that long, you got a good understanding of what you need to do to thrive in that occupation. You can start passing those lessons on. But not if you're treading water. So I just looked at it as I had to do that if I wanted to stay in the community.
Right. And you took a training position. Is that correct?
I was a second phase BUDS instructor when I submitted my package for commissioning. And because I went from an enlisted sailor to an officer, I had to leave that command upon receiving my commission. So then I went over and did a deployment with SEAL Team 3.
Okay. So what happened during, you know, the end of your specifically SEAL career that made you decide, okay, enough is enough. I'm going to pack it up.
Well, I didn't want to. I mean, I think I can start there and say that if I hadn't have been injured, I definitely would have done my full 20 years. I probably would have done more. I love the job. But on that last deployment in 2010, the residual from the injury definitely peaked its head a few times. And for me, there was either an interaction with my sciatic nerve from the projectile itself or the shock wave. Like when you look at a gelatin block that's hit with a bullet, you can see the shock waves. The doctors don't know, right? I've never been told I don't know so many times by people with 7 years of medical school. But it's like, hey, is my nerve going to grow back? I don't know. I'm like, okay, cool. I didn't go to medical school. I could give you that answer. But anyway, I digress. So I had some frustrations when I was talking to the docs. Nothing against the profession. But for me, I have a hard time when I roll my ankle. My left leg, I have a hard time controlling. If I'm standing on a slope like, and my right leg is higher than my left, I am constantly in danger of rolling my ankle to the outside. And a couple times that happened on that deployment. And I literally had to lay down and like wrap it. It ballooned up purple. I can barely feel my ankle. But when I can feel pain in my ankle, I know I probably have done some damage. And when I got back, I almost called a medevac in once for myself because I rolled it that bad. And in that moment, I realized that I was putting the other people that I was with in jeopardy. And I never wanted to be that guy. I never want to be the guy where other people are like, God damn it. Like we're waiting on Andy, or everything would have gone great if Andy hadn't, filled in the blank. So that was a tough moment. And then I got back from that deployment and realized I talked to the officer detailer about what I would need to do to continue in my officer progression. And she said I would need to do another 2 back-to-back deployments to fill those mandatory advancement wickets. And I just couldn't do it. My body was not going to tolerate that. I wasn't willing to put other people at risk. And I started pursuing the route of just blanketly getting out of the military. I would rather get out of the military than put people at risk. And that's when I met Kirk, and he redirected that process for me.
Okay. And how many years did you have on at that point?
I did 1 month under 17 years.
Did you get any sort of pension when you left?
So I was medically retired. So I get my retirement as if I had done 20 years.
Okay, good. All right.
I'm going to use the term retirement very loosely. If you think you're going to do 20 years in the Navy and retire, what they should say is, here's your check so you can find your second job.
Right. A stipend, pocket money.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. So then let's talk about when you got out. So I want to touch on the wingsuit flight briefly, but I also want to see, you know, about the other things that you're doing, more importantly, which are the reason for the wing flight. So, or the wingsuit flight. So, what did the first few months look like after you'd left? You know, you've been in this incredible brotherhood for 17 years and all of a sudden the door closes behind you. What were those first few moments like?
For me, they weren't that bad, because I had been working for CrossFit on the weekends while still active duty, and I transitioned to a full-time role with the organization. So I had an avenue to pursue from a occupational setting and from an economic setting. So it wasn't a rough transition. It was very rough leaving a job that I considered to have a huge impact, and then watching the news and having no ability to impact the stuff that I was seeing. So I struggled with that, but very fortunately I had a solid economic platform that I was working from.
Okay. So what gave you the idea to strap on a wingsuit and jump out of a plane extremely high and try and go as far horizontally as you possibly can?
Well, I don't know how to juggle. Right. If I knew how to juggle, I would have done that. But a buddy of mine, we were sitting around one day talking over a drink, and he had brought up the idea of fundraising and trying to give back to the SEAL community. And I was looking at what I do in my life, and I was jumping at the time, and you know, that's what I knew how to do. So I just took something that I knew how to do and tried to do something positive with it that was for a cause that's much bigger than myself.
Okay. And then I don't think there's any way of me getting the same response from you, so I have to repeat it. But when you were on, I think it was Jocko's podcast, and you talked about when you jumped out, you lost control of the initial descent, and he asked you, you know, what happened. And you said, because you weren't very good in a in a wingsuit. I thought that was very humble.
Maybe you should have the requisite amount of training and experience before you attempt something like that. And I didn't, but the day arrived, and I sent it with what I had. And worked it out. You know, I got out of the spin pretty fast. It wasn't an awesome few seconds, but I'm still here talking with you.
Yeah, exactly. So you landed, that was complete, and that was for the SEAL Foundation, is that right, that you did that for?
Correct.
Okay.
The Navy SEAL Foundation.
Okay. And I'm going to put a link to that in the podcast too. So that's about the only thing that I've seen that you've done post SEAL, obviously, apart from the FireX talk, which we'll talk about very briefly in a moment. But so what's next? What are you looking at right now?
From a professional perspective, I'm trying to do more with less. I spent about half of my year doing obligation stuff for my sponsors in the skydiving and base jumping world. So I'm trying to figure out ways to do high impact but less time content projects. So just combining some of my travel and instead of separating it and doing a week here and 2 weeks there. Kind of the same thing with the public speaking. I'd say the other half of my year is caught up with public speaking, and I love doing it. And but I have to trim away some of the requests that I get, because at the same time, on a personal level, I'm trying to do more with less also with my family. I'm trying to maximize my time there and spend less time on the road. But it's a balance. You know, there's an economic demand that I have on the family side of the house, and I'm just kind of taking it a day at a time. So on a professional level, I'm just trying to move the rock down the field. And at a personal level, I'm just continuing to try to find new stuff that challenges me. And last year I picked up bow hunting, and you want to talk about something that's challenging. I mean, it's unbelievably hard. We moved to Montana. We now have access to snow sports. So I'm picking up some snow sports stuff, trying to chase down my kids. And I really love not being good at things and then trying to figure them out.
Yeah, no, I do too. But so that was the reason for the move then, to get away completely and put yourself in a more wild setting.
I would say that was like the lowest of the priorities. I mean, one, my wife is from Montana, and it's amazing. I don't think I've ever met somebody who is from Montana that hasn't voiced a desire to get back if they've moved away. So she definitely wanted to come back. We looked at it from an economic perspective, you know, the cost of living, and then into that, the quality of living, and then the impact that it would have on our kids' lives. And there's nothing wrong with living in a city. But for my kids, we had actually come up to the area that where we had moved for 2 years in a row over Christmas. So I got to see the difference in my kids. And that in and of itself and alone was worth the move coming up here. And just, I mean, you kind of play a craps game. I mean, I don't work here in Kalispell. I have to travel for all the work that I do. So it was a little bit of a gamble. But I mean, to see the difference in my kids and to see them thriving, I mean, I can't think of anything more worthwhile.
No, that's fantastic. All right. So one quick question before I ask the little wrap up ones that I always do. How did you get invited to the FireX talk that I saw you on?
God, I wish I could give you an answer on that. I think it was through my buddy Ed Hadfield, who was the fire chief in Coronado when I opened my CrossFit gym there. I'm relatively certain that he linked me up with them, but that was so long ago. I'm gonna say it was, but there's a 1% chance I'm wrong.
Okay. All right. I don't think anyone will hold you to it. So,
yeah.
All right. So, well, speaking of time, I want to be, appreciative of the time that you've given. So firstly, thank you so much. And secondly, let me ask a few of the wrap-up questions so you can get back to your kids. The first question I always ask is there a book that you recommend to people? It can be about anything at all.
I do read quite a bit, and I bounce back and forth between fiction and nonfiction just because I need to, it seems like half of what we're living through these days are fiction. So I need at least a little bit of a mental release. On the nonfiction side of the house, I did actually, you know, you brought up Sebastian Younger. I read his book recently, Tribe. I think it's a great book. His book War is also a great book. I love the book About Face. I love the book Boyd. It's about the OODA loop. And I believe the title of it is Boyd, the fighter pilot that changed the face of warfare. But all of those are exceptionally good books.
Fantastic. What about a movie or a documentary
Well, I would just go with the movie that is a documentary, which is American Sniper.
Okay.
Which is a joke. Don't watch that movie. don't watch any movies that have anything to do with SEALs, because I'll tell you what, you answer this question for me. How accurate is Backdraft?
Extremely accurate. Normally when we go into a fire, we remove our masks, stand up, and have a relaxed conversation.
Perfect. And that's exactly how accurate the SEAL movies are. So just take them. Go watch whatever you want to. I don't care if you go watch the Smurfs. Just take movies as they are for entertainment.
Okay. Is there a movie or documentary that you have? It doesn't have to be about SEAL Team. It could be about anything that has struck you as, okay, that was worth 90 minutes of my time.
I'm going to go back to Sebastian Younger and say Restrepo.
Yes. Excellent. Okay.
Yep.
All right. So I will not put American Sniper on the, on the webpage.
You can, but it should fall into the genre of comedy, not documentary.
All right. So the next one is one of my favorite questions these days. Is there a person that you would recommend come on this podcast to talk to the police, fire, medics of the world?
I think Jocko would be a great person. I love, you know, it's funny. I love what he's doing, and I love that he is who he is. The leadership lessons and messages and philosophies in the SEAL teams, they're no different than they are in the business world and than they are in the fire service or police. I mean, there's really not. There's good leadership and there's bad. There's effective leadership and there's ineffective leadership, but you have to be able to verbalize and articulate that. And I think Jocko does a wonderful job of doing that often and regularly. So he'd be a good one. I'm going to go with that. I'm going to go with my final answer, Jocko.
Brilliant. Yeah, I've had JP Donnell and Dave Burke, both from Echelon Front, already on the show. So I keep poking Jocko, but I'm waiting for a response. But all right.
I think the guy's what I would call busy.
Oh, no, exactly. No, and I know he knows they're on the radar, so one day, if he finds a moment. And the other thing, I would actually like to reach out to someone one day who I know you spend some time with is Joe Rogan. I think he'd be fascinating to interview as well.
Joe is a fascinating interview. I don't know how that would go. I don't know what kind of leadership lessons you would get for the fire service, but I guarantee you it would be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, and not every episode is about the fire service. I have a whole diverse spectrum because you can always learn from someone's life story. So,
yeah, he's an incredibly accomplished individual. You know, people forget that. I mean, look at everything he's done in his life. Like, he's killing it.
Yeah, exactly. And I've followed martial arts and UFC for years, and even just his philosophies on a lot of things I tend to align with. But all right, so one last question before we talk about where we can find you and certainly underline again the charities that you're fundraising for. What do you do to decompress when you're not flinging yourself out of airplanes?
Sweat. I try to sweat every single day. And I know it sounds dumb and it sounds easy. And maybe it is dumb and maybe it is easy. At least I know it is easy. But for me, I get a huge mental and emotional release just from raising my heart rate and just, you know, you got to burn the junk out of the engine. And if you don't, for me, momentum is a huge thing in my life. If I can get a couple days going and feeling good and knocking things out the way that I want to, it's so much easier for me to maintain that. And over the holidays, when I eat an entire carrot cake for breakfast and then I have a cheesecake for lunch, it's rough because I got the momentum going in the other direction. So for me, if I don't get some type of physical release via activity, I really struggle. And I think if I could change one thing about the culture right now in the U.S., it would be just get out and experience more. And by that, I don't mean look at it through an Instagram page. I mean, go do it your damn self.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I think this morning you posted that it looked like your snowshoes up at the top of a mountain. That is one of my...
Skinned up about 2,000 feet and then boarded. That's a split board, so it goes back together into a snowboard and then boarded down, you know, an hour and a half before the resort even opened.
Yeah, beautiful. I don't think you can describe to someone what it's like standing on the top of a mountain with just a piece of wood strapped to your feet until they've done it, but it's the most exhilarating feeling in the world, in my opinion.
I agree, but I wouldn't use wood. It's 2018 and they have some many much more upgraded like polymers and combinations of stuff, but you do you, buddy.
All right, so let's talk about the very last thing then. So the Navy SEAL Foundation, if people listening want to contribute after hearing this, what's the best way of doing that? And then you know, are there any other organizations that you'd like to put on the radar as well?
So the Navy SEAL Foundation, NavySEALFoundation.org, it's an amazing organization. And, you know, it's hard to describe how bad it would be, having not experienced this myself, but having seen it from a distance and then up close with close friends as well. But the knock on the door, and nobody wants to live through that. And I honestly don't know how some people do, because it's catastrophic. And most times the SEAL Foundation is right there with that knock, and they stay with the families until they don't need them anymore. There's no window like, hey, we got you for 6 months and then we're out of here. It's we're here. But just do some research on them. You know, it talks about how much for every dollar goes to the charity, or not to the charity, towards the end state of what you're actually donating for. They have a variety of tranches you could donate towards. And it talks about everything that they do. I mean, I could spend 30 minutes talking about that. But I also understand that for some people, SEALs aren't their thing. And the great thing about where we are now in 2018 is the last number I heard was 40,000. And that's service-based organizations that are out there existing to help and support the veteran community, regardless of branch, and go find one that you resonate with. If you come from an Air Force family, go find an Air Force one or a Marine Corps or Army or whatever it may be. And just, you know, give back if you can. And if you can't, then don't. But, you know, do the best you can.
Absolutely. No, I agree 100%. If you can spare, you know, $5 for a Frappuccino, you can certainly throw some money towards a good cause.
Who buys a $5 Frappuccino? It better be $7.50. You need to get the bigger one, upside down, caramel macchiato. I mean, you better earn it.
Absolutely. And then get your diabetes meds on the way out too.
Yeah, why not?
All right. One thing I just forgot to talk about as well. You started a podcast, the Cleared Hot podcast. So just very briefly, how did you get into that, and where can people find that too?
So just like any other podcast, you can find it in iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play and all that stuff. And it actually came from a recommendation from Joe. I listen to people who are smarter than me and are more experienced than me. And he's, you know, I was talking to him one day. He's like, hey, man, you should start your own podcast. So there you go.
I think he was responsible for Jocko starting his too, wasn't he? Between him and Tim Ferriss, probably.
Joe is probably single-handedly responsible for a number of podcasts. But again, the guy's moderately successful from what I've told.
Mildly.
In the podcast space. Yeah. So when the guy says, hey, maybe you should look at this, maybe you should look at it.
Yeah, exactly. No, him, Tim Ferriss, and Bob L. Shrugged were definitely instrumental in me just pulling the trigger on this. So anyway, with that being said, let me let you get back to your family. So thank you so much for being so generous. I know that you do spend a lot of time talking. You are pulled from all these different directions. But for you to reach out to the first responders of the world, I truly, truly appreciate it.
Definitely my pleasure. And every time I speak in front of a first responder crowd, it's very common for people to say to me, thank you for your service. And of course, I always say, thank you. You're very welcome. It was definitely my privilege and my honor to do so. And I actually personally think that a lot of times the first responder crowd, they don't get the credit they deserve. And if you really look at what makes this world spin, and especially in the United States, it's a thin veneer that holds everything together. And there are not too many people doing a whole hell of a lot to try to keep this thing together. And even in comparison to my old job, I would train and be home, and then I would deploy for 6 months, maybe 10 months, and then I would come back. And you guys and your community, you're on the clock 24/7. And that needs to be recognized as well. So I appreciate everything that the first responder community does in their service and sacrifice, at least in my family, definitely doesn't go unnoticed.